Solomon builds the temple. In the 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. The temple that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 wide, and 30 high. The portico at the front of the main hall of the temple extended the width of the temple, that is, 20 cubits, and projected 10 cubits from the front of the temple. He made narrow clerestory windows in the temple. Against the walls of the main hall and inner sanctuary, he built a structure around the building in which there were side rooms. The lowest floor was 5 cubits wide, the middle floor 6 cubits, and the third floor 7. He made offset ledges around the outside of the temple so that nothing would be inserted into the temple walls. In building the temple, only blocks dressed at the quarry were used, and no hammer, chisel, or any other iron tool was heard at the temple site whilst it was being built. The entrance to the lowest floor was on the south side of the temple. A stairway led up to the middle level and from there to the third. So he built the temple and completed it, roofing it with beams and cedar planks. And he built the side rooms all along the temple. The height of each was 5 cubits, and they were attached to the temple by beams of cedar. The word of the Lord came to Solomon, "As for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel." So Solomon built the temple and completed it. He lined its interior walls with cedar boards, paneling them from the floor of the temple to the ceiling, and covered the floor of the temple with planks of pine. He partitioned off 20 cubits at the rear of the temple with cedar boards from floor to ceiling to form within the temple an inner sanctuary, the most holy place. The main hall in front of this room was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar, carved with gourds and open flowers. Everything was cedar, no stone was to be seen. He prepared the inner sanctuary within the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 wide, and 20 high. He overlaid the inside with pure gold, and he also overlaid the altar of cedar. Solomon covered the inside of the temple with pure gold, and he extended gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary, which was overlaid with gold. So he overlaid the whole interior with gold. He also overlaid with gold the altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary. In the inner sanctuary, he made a pair of cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. One wing of the first cherub was 5 cubits long, and the other wing 5 cubits, 10 cubits from wingtip to wingtip. The second cherub also measured 10 cubits, for the two cherubim were identical in size and shape. The height of each cherub was 10 cubits. He placed the cherubim inside the innermost room of the temple with their wings spread out. The wing of one cherub touched one wall, while the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. He overlaid the cherubim with gold. On the walls all around the temple, in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He also covered the floors of both the inner and outer rooms of the temple with gold. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood with five-sided jambs. And on the two olive wood doors, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and overlaid the cherubim and palm trees with beaten gold. In the same way, he made four-sided jambs of olive wood for the entrance to the main hall. He also made two pine doors, each having two leaves that turned in sockets. He carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them, and overlaid them with gold hammered evenly over the carvings. And he built the inner courtyard of three courses of dressed stone and one course of trimmed cedar beams. The foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the fourth year in the month of Ziv. In the 11th year in the month of Bol, the 8th month, the temple was finished in all its details according to its specification. He had spent 7 years building it.
It's not much of a secret. I don't enjoy moving home, and I don't enjoy setting up a new home. The thought of moving furniture, a refits and building work, will either fill me with terror or boredom. It amazes me, though, how many people actually really enjoy that kind of stuff. There are whole magazines designed that just kind of talk about renovations and home design and all those kinds of things. Ones like this one, Ideal Home. You'll notice it's still in its packaging, which claims to be Britain's best-selling home magazine, which scares me for two reasons. One is that this is the best-selling one, and that there's a whole number of them, that this is the best of the lot. In this month's edition, you'll find advice and creative ideas on things like inspiring kitchen and bathroom refits, stylish homes, including 50s semi, a Victorian villa, 30s terrace, modern detached and 70s bungalow, and the best warm neutrals for your wall. There's probably some of you thinking, he hasn't even opened it yet. Why hasn't he opened it yet? If I was in a waiting room for a week and this was the only magazine, I probably wouldn't open it. Terror and boredom. And as I come to 1 Kings 6 to 7, I kind of have similar feelings. Because on the surface, at least, these chapters are about building and interior decorating. They read like plans for a major building work in chapter 6. And followed up by interior decorating ideas in chapter 7. They get me about as excited as an episode of Location, Location. For me, this is one of those parts of the Bible which I've heard described as inspiration that demands perspiration. But sitting in the detail of these inspired chapters are four ideas, which I think when we put them together, I think gives us one of the most complete guides to living for God. And I think we could even go as far as saying as living for Jesus, probably that we're going to find anywhere in the Bible. The first idea to help us live for Jesus is this. The motivation to live for Jesus comes from hope in his promises. Before we are overwhelmed with the details of pomegranates, cherubs, and other carefully crafted decorations, we need to see that something is highlighted which explains why Solomon is motivated to do what he does. Everything that happens in these chapters is driven by God's promise. You see, there's power that motivates people for action. power that motivates people to do stuff in the promise of God. See, this emphasis on God's promise continues the whole way through the section. In chapter 6, verse 1, now hopefully you're still there in 1 Kings, in chapter 6, verse 1, the time frames are given to us to teach us this. It says there, in the 480th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. See, God's promises won't always be fulfilled at the speed that we'd like. Sometimes we may need to wait, maybe even 480 years, but it will be fulfilled. And the emphasis on the time frame tells us that this event, this building of the temple, is the biggest event since the Exodus itself. God has kept his promise to Abraham. The large nation of Israel has settled in the promised land. They've moved in. God has come through on his promises. God's people, like we said last week, God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. 1 Kings 6, 11 to 13 makes it even clearer that this temple building project has got everything to do with God's promises to his people. Take a look at 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 11. The word of the Lord came to Solomon. As for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father. And I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel. This is typical promise language that we see in the Old Testament. It's the language God used when he spoke to Abraham, to Moses, to Joshua, to David, and to others. He spoke using these kinds of ideas. Keep my commands. I'll keep my promises. And you'll be blessed. You see, details in the construction of the temple remind us of this as well. There's a great big bronze water dish that's described in chapter 7 called the sea. And it's one of these reminders. It served as a reminder that God is the Lord over the chaotic sea. Whether the Red Sea is a symbol of keeping his promises through the Exodus, or just pre-creation hostility and disorder, God has it covered. He is the Lord who keeps his promises because he is the Lord who is capable of keeping all his promises. In the same way, we have detailed information about these two freestanding pillars in chapter 7, complete with some impressive lily work on the top. It reminds Israel that God is a promise-making, keeping God. Take a look at chapter 7, verse 21. He, that is Solomon, erected the pillars at the portico of the temple. The pillar to the south he named Jachin, and the one to the north, Boaz. The capitals on top were in the shape of lilies, and so the work on the pillars was completed. The names of the pillars mean strength, and he establishes. And if you had to read these pillars from left to right, like you would do in Hebrew, the language of Israel, these pillars together proclaim, in strength, he establishes. The pillars remind us of the power and the promise of God. They allude to our helplessness, but also proclaim God's determination to bless through David's descendants. God promised numerous times to establish David's descendants on the throne, and he does so in strength. These pillars were a great reminder of God's faithfulness to his people. In strength, God establishes. God keeps his promises. And that is the ultimate motivation for sticking at living for God. The basic principle here and many other places in the Bible is that hope is the engine that drives living for Jesus. If living for Jesus was a car, and you lifted the bonnet, you'd find hope where the engine should be. Our trouble is that sometimes We're more like an old school Beetle. The Beetle's engine is in the back. We lift the bonnet, and where we expect to find the engine, we find an empty space and an old, usually flat tire. And then we wonder why living for Jesus is so hard. It's harder than it needs to be because we don't hope in God's promises. You see, if we want to follow Jesus till the very end, if we want to throw ourselves into serving him by serving his church for a whole lifetime, if we want to live for Jesus, then it's vital that we get this. Motivation to live for Jesus comes from hope in his promises. There are many promises in the Bible, but the Bible gives us five promises that we find in the New Testament, which God fulfills through Jesus, which should motivate us to live for Jesus. There are many others, but here's five. Promise to give us hope. Christ will grow his church. People will be saved. Should be a slide for that, Wes? Cool, thank you. Secondly, God will finish his work in us. God's people, those that are saved, will grow in spiritual maturity. And he will get us to his eternal kingdom. A third promise we can hope in is that God will judge the world through Jesus. Some will face judgment, and others will find salvation. Fourthly, God will make everything new, reconciling all things to himself through Jesus. God's kingdom will be perfect. And the last one, we will see God as he is, and we will enjoy him forever. See, if we don't get any of that, if it doesn't excite us, then we will lack the motivation needed to live for Jesus. You see, thankfulness is important, and it will work as a motivator for a short while, but eventually it's going to wear off. See, we need to be motivated by hope. We must see that the motivation to live for God comes from hope in his promises. That's the first thing. The second thing we need to see is that to live for Jesus, we must see his splendor. See, details are really, really important. Getting them wrong can land you in a lot of trouble. You could be waiting at the bus station at 6 a.m. instead of 6 p.m. You could say that you are 5.7 meters tall instead of 5'7". See, companies have lost millions due to online shopping typos. A Japanese bank once sold shares for a recruitment company on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. Instead of selling them at 610,000 yen a share, they sold them at 610,000 shares for a yen. And in less than a day, the company lost 258 million pounds. Details matter. Marissa Mayer was the former CEO of Yahoo. She said this: "Geeks are people who love something so much that all the details matter." And there is a lot of detail in 1 Kings chapter 6 and chapter 7. It's all over the place. When they're talking about the doors of the temple, what do we get? We get detail. Take a look at chapter 6, verse 33. "In the same way, for the entrance to the main hall, he made door frames out of olive wood that were 1/4 of the width of the hall. He also made two doors out of juniper wood, each having two leaves that turned in sockets. He carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them, and overlaid them with gold hammered evenly over the carvings. And he built the inner courtyard of three courses of dressed stone and one course of trimmed cedar beams." All this detail, when he's talking about the massive bronze water holder, what do we get? Detail. When he talks about the inner sanctuary, detail. Bronze pillars, detail. Lots and lots and lots of detail. And I think there's two reasons why we have all this detail in chapter 6 and chapter 7. The first reason is theological. The attention paid to the carvings and the replicas of flowers and lilies and palm trees and pomegranates and all the kinds of leaves and the importance of using cedar and cypress is intentional. I think it's meant to remind us of the Garden of Eden. See, this temple is where God has made it possible for his people to meet with him again, just like they could in the Garden of Eden. In Eden, God walked with Adam and Eve. And these details are saying that at the temple, God was present amongst his people again. Not quite in the same way, but present nonetheless. Theological, God is here at the temple. The second reason is doxological. Doxology is just a short hymn of praise to God. When we see the details of the temple, it should force us to praise God. All this detail is given. All this painstaking care is required because of the sheer overwhelming beauty of God. See, I think the author of 1 Kings wants us to see that God is worth it. I think it's rammed home by the fact that no one would actually even ever see so much of the temple that was described to us now. No one would ever walk on the gold floor. The gold leaf on the walls wasn't there to stop little fingers from getting splinters as they ran their fingers along the wall of the temple, because there wasn't going to be any little fingers in the temple. Actually, not even big fingers anywhere near most parts of the temple. All this craftsmanship was going into a room which no one would ever enter. So what is the point? The point is that such care is demanded simply by the splendor and perfection of God. That's the symbolism. The audio tour is given for the benefit of those of us and those in Israel who would never get into the temple, at least not past the porch, to give them a picture of the magnificence and the attractiveness and the majesty of the living God. And I think that all sounds just maybe a little bit strange for us today. We live in a world where churches have comfortable seats, large mixing desks, and high-quality speakers as we think about outsiders. And I think we do need to think about outsiders. And we need to think about how outsiders view our building and what we do. But that's not what's going on here in 1 Kings 6 and 7. The temple wasn't made for outsiders. Hardly any Israelites were ever going to set foot inside the temple, let alone outsiders. See, something else is going on here. All this stuff is done purely and only for God. You see, this beauty, this artwork, is all for God's sake. The craftsmen who made all this were not doing it for public acclaim. They weren't doing it to go on exhibition, but simply to honor and to please God. They were satisfied and fulfilled in doing work that no one else would ever see, simply because they were doing it for God. I think we've lost sight of doing things purely and simply for God. When was the last time you did something for God that nobody else would see? What this passage does here is take us inside the temple and makes us sit and watch as some unknown guys carve some pretty patterns that no one else will ever see. So we get the idea that the detail in the temple reflects God's splendor. And when we see God's splendor, we can live for him. Solomon's temple is ultimately a reflection of the beauty of God. You've probably noticed that this building that we're in at the moment looks nothing like Solomon's temple. And that's because the temple and this building have totally different purposes. The temple was a symbol of God's presence among his people and of God's splendor. This building is just a place for us to meet. The temple itself was there to honor God. But here's the thing. It's not this building that honors God. We are the ones who are to honor God. We are the ones that are to honor God with our lives as we live for Him, and not the building. In 1 Corinthians 6, Paul gives a few examples from everyday life of how believers can live for God. And in these verses, he deals with sexual immorality, and he reminds us that we must honor God in the way that we live. Paul says this: "Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against his own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. Honor God with your lives." This is a massive, huge, big responsibility. But now that Jesus has come and given us His Spirit, we are the temples that should display the splendor of God by living for Him. You see, the motivation to live for Jesus comes from hope in His promises. And in order to live for Jesus, we must see His splendor. We must also have the right priorities. To live for Jesus, we must have the right priorities. Right in the middle of this description of the temple, we're interrupted with information about Solomon's palace. Interruptions in the Old Testament are almost always important. They're there to grab our attention, to say, "Oi, look at this, take note of this." And it's true here as well. The author is underlining something for us. In chapter 6, verse 2, if we convert cubits to meters, we read that Solomon's temple measured 30 meters long by 9 meters wide and 14 meters high. By ancient standards, that's impressive. So well done, Solomon. But if we read on, start with me in chapter 6, verse 37. Again, as I read it, I'm going to convert cubits to meters. "The foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the fourth year in the month of Ziv, in the 11th year in the month of Bul, the 8th month. The temple was finished in all its detail according to its specifications. He had spent 7 years building it. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. He built the palace of the forest of Lebanon, 46 meters long, 23 meters wide, and 14 meters high, with 4 rows of cedar columns supporting trimmed cedar beams. It was roofed with cedar above the beams that rested on the columns, 45 beams, 15 to a row." So if you do the maths, the temple was roughly 3,780 cubic meters, while Solomon's palace was 14,812 cubic meters. And it took him nearly twice as long to build. The narrator here is much less interested in Solomon's palace than God's temple. But it's very clear to us where Solomon's priorities lie. Isn't it? Yes, he built a house for God, but he built a bigger house for himself. That must have sent a pretty clear message in the ancient world, just as it does today. This interruption is here to make sure we get the fact that even though Solomon did a great job on the temple, his building plans were spoiled by his priorities. It's not that Solomon shouldn't have built a palace, but the house that he builds says a lot about him. That's still true today. Where we choose to live, the size of the house we live in, the car we choose to drive, the way we spend our money, is, whether we like it or not, a pretty good gauge of where our heart is. What if I sent a video cameraman around to your home to film you as you go about your daily business? We'll get to see your house and get to see your bedroom, your garage, your bank account, your phone. How would you feel? What does the evidence say? Does it say I live for God or I live for me? Does it say it's all about Jesus or it's all about me? Sadly, in Solomon's case, it was obvious. I don't think this passage is telling us that we all need to be living in one-bedroom flats. I think what it's telling us, if we have a lot, then give a lot. Our priority needs to be Jesus. The motivation to live for Jesus comes from hope in his promises. And in order to live for Jesus, we must see his splendor. And we must have the right priorities. And to live for Jesus, we must depend on him. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 11 to 13 is the key passage in this section. The word of the Lord came to Solomon. As for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father. And I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel. See, I think what grabs our attention here is that God is actually downplaying the significance of the temple. It's as if God says, thanks for the temple, but don't worry about the temple. It's not the main issue, Solomon. The main issue is you. It's not the main issue, the temple. You are. So no pressure then, Solomon. Everything is dependent on you. God makes it clear that the future of his people is all on the obedience of one man. If Solomon manages to walk in God's statutes, obey God's rules, keep all God's commands and walk in them, then all will be well. God will live among them. If Israel is to flourish, this is what it's going to take. It all depends on David's son, on Solomon. The problem, as we've already seen, is that Solomon isn't all that dependable. He has had his moments. He's built a great temple. He's made some great choices. He's written some great books. And as we'll see next week, he's prayed some amazing prayers. But he's also made some terrible, terrible choices. He built a very great temple to himself. He even goes along and builds another palace for his pagan wife. It all depends on the son of David. And if it does, then maybe the future doesn't look so bright after all for Israel and God's people. Here's a spoiler alert that we all need to hear. In 1 Kings, we're going to see that the son of David is going to fail spectacularly. He won't keep his side of the promise by walking in the laws, the statutes, and all the commands of God. And God won't live among his people for all that long. And one day, like in the garden, God will remove his presence from his people and his people from the land. And in a sense, they won't even be his people any longer. That's until one day. Until one day that Matthew describes for us in chapter 12 of his gospel, where an argument starts about whether or not Jesus is greater than David. Later, when they encounter a demon-possessed man and Jesus delivers him, the crowd asks, could this be the son of David? Just a few lines after that, Jesus himself announces that one greater than Solomon is here. We don't need to turn there. It's just a few just a few words. Matthew chapter 12, verse 42. And now, one greater than Solomon is here. King Jesus is David's son, who is greater than Solomon and greater than David. He is the one who is the fulfillment of God's promises. He is the one who truly delights in the Father, who obeys his every decree, law, and command, and who makes it possible for us to share and delight in the Lord, in God. He is the one who doesn't just build a temple, but who is the temple of God. Jesus is the one who is not only God's king, but fulfills all God's promises. Jesus is not only the temple, but he's also the sacrifice. He is the perfect sacrifice. In obedience, even to death on a cross, he dies in our place, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring us to God. And that's what's going to happen in a moment, and that's what we're going to celebrate in a moment as we come to the Lord's Supper. It's always moving to end a sermon with a really good illustration. There is no better illustration than the greatness of Jesus and all that Jesus has done for us in a moment when we come to the Lord's table and celebrate the Lord's Supper and remember what the Lord Jesus did for us on the cross. The motivation to live for Jesus comes from hope in his promises. And in order to live for Jesus, we must see his splendor. To live for Jesus, we must have the right priorities. And we must depend on him.